And in my mind, according to my ideas of what an AA is, he epitomizes AA to me. And I'm so happy that you folks are here tonight to hear this dear friend of all of ours, Chuck C. of Southern California.
Thank you, OK. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First, I want to thank you all for giving me the privilege to share this evening with you. And second, I want to thank you all for coming. You know, I think it helps if you're going to make a little talk someplace if somebody comes to hear it. It's good. And third, I want to welcome you or insist that you all come down to Southern California on the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July for our 25th anniversary convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. You should make it a must to be there because Bill and Lois will be there and we'll talk and there'll be lots of other fine things and lots of good coffee. And lots of barefoot AA. So, make it a must. That's the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July of this year. Next, I'd like to tell you that my sermon has already been preached because I am my sermon. Whereas I was a hopeless, helpless drunk, tonight I'm sober. And whereas I was one of the most miserable amongst men, tonight I'm reasonably happy and at peace. And that's the sermon. That's it. I didn't do it. It's by the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and through the grace of God. I've lived now for a little over 5,000 days. Without the necessity to take a drink of liquor or a sedating pill of any kind. Unless some of you get lost in arithmetic and miss my profound remarks of the evening, I will tell you that that's somewhat over 14 years. And you won't have to do any figures. Now, one of the things that come with us to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, or one of the things that keep us from coming to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for a long, long time, is because we think we're different. We think we're different. I thought that nobody, but nobody, had ever had my trouble. I had always recognized that alcohol could get such as you. But it couldn't get me because I was too smart. And I figured that when people talked to me about this trouble of mine, I figured they didn't know what they were talking about in the first place. Particularly, for instance, my minister, I could be bouncing about 3 feet off the sidewalk, and I could look that old boy right in the eye and pity him when he tried to talk to me, because I could say to myself, why does he know about liquor? He never had a drink in his life. And I could top it all off by saying, besides, if he had my trouble, he'd be drunk too. So we all think we're different. We're different. And the one wonderful thing about going to a lot of meetings, even though it doesn't appear that it's doing much for you, is that if you stick around a little while, you find out that we're only different in our similarity. We alcoholics are as alike as black-eyed peas. And it's an awful good thing to find that out. You know, coming into my first meeting, I was sure that I was alone. And I remained to find that my problems were just the same as yours. The only difference is time, place, and degree. What happened to you, and what happened to me. I happened to live in Beverly Hills during the worst period of my drinking, and I spent some time in the Beverly Hills Bastille. Well, now that's a real good jail. It's clean, and they have nice beds, and if any of you are alumna of Lincoln Heights down our way, it was much better to be in the Beverly Hills jail than in Lincoln Heights, because I've been there too. So it's a real good thing to find out that we're not alone, that we're all alike. It's a good thing also to know that it's easier to stay sober than it is to get sober. So all of you who are here and sober, if you just keep that in mind, it's a lot easier to stay sober than to get sober. You might be all right. And another thing that we like to think of once in a while is that we don't want to get too far behind or too far in front. This is a 24-hour program. And I believe that this is the second greatest thing I've ever learned in my life. To live 24 hours at a time. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. We have a little prayer that I love very much. It says, God grant us the serenity to accept the things we can't change, the courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, one of the things that we can't change is yesterday. The combined intelligence of the human race can't change one thought or act of yesterday. And the quicker we can get this through our heads, the better off we are. Because there's no necessity to carry yesterday's burdens. We can't do a thing about it. I remember some years ago I was up in Fresno and we had a meeting up there, and then we had another meeting, as we will here perhaps tonight. And along about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was out in the kitchen with our host. The young fellow had a very nice family. He's from Winston-Salem. And he says, Chuck, every so often I have to get drunk. He says, I get to thinking about the miserable time I gave my wife and my kids, and I have to get drunk. And I says, I don't blame you. If I got to thinking about crucifying my wife and my kids, I'd be drunk before I get to Bakersfield. There's no sense in thinking about what we've done to our wives and our kids. The only thing we can do about it is to add a little something to their lives today. We need not carry the burdens of the past. Yesterday is gone. It's a canceled check. And another thing that we can't do anything about is tomorrow. Tomorrow isn't even ours, it's God's. We might not even be here tomorrow. And even though there might be a significance to next Tuesday, maybe you got to appear before the judge at that time, you know. there's nothing you can do about that until Tuesday. So we don't live yesterday and we don't live tomorrow in AA. This is my day to do with the best I can with what I have and let the chips fall where they may. This, I think, is the second greatest lesson I've learned in life. Makes life real simple. Real simple. You know, you can't even starve to death in 24 hours. Makes it real simple. So we do the best we can today to live according to these principles. Now, we don't get sober by these principles, in my way of thinking. We get sober by the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we remain sober by the practice of the principles. Nearly every one of us have known these principles since we were knee-high to a cup. And we couldn't get sober knowing them. I could preach a pretty good sermon 25 years ago on any one of these steps if somebody would hold me up while I was making it. So it is by the Spirit that we get sober, and it reminds me of a little thing that was going on down in San Diego some years ago. And on that particular occasion, I was up on a thing like this also. And there were 500 or 600 people in the room, and by the time I got down, I was in the end of the line, the coffee line, and I was standing back there commiserating with myself, thinking how long it was going to be between drinks. And an old boy came up to me, he was a little older than I, and he had a great big battery hanging on him and a thing in his ear. And he says, young man, he's thereby endearing himself to me considerably. He says, you were the speaker tonight, weren't you? And I said, yes. And he says, eh? And I said, yes. And he says, well, I've got a question for you. And I said, go ahead. Then he yelled, eh, again. And I yelled at him, go ahead. And he says, I asked this question of a panel a while back, and they couldn't answer it. And so I finally got him that question. And he says, well, can you tell me how a man can come to these meetings and get sober and stay sober when he can't hear a goddamn word that's said? And when I could talk again, I yelled at him and told him I couldn't answer his question either. And he says, well, I didn't hear a thing that was said tonight, but I think I know everything that was said. He says, there is a spirit here. There is a spirit here, and most certainly there is a spirit here. And it's by the Spirit that we get sober. And by the practice of the principles that we remain sober. And in my book, the spirit that allows us to share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love is the spirit of Almighty God. Truly, there is a miracle here. Now, if you would ask me how to get sober, I would say don't drink. Don't take that next drink. Leave it alone. And you might say, but don't you know I crave the stuff? And I might say, yes, I know. With every fiber of your being, you crave the stuff. But don't take that next drink and the craving will go away. And you might say, but I'll shake my liver out. And I might say, go ahead and shake your liver out. Maybe you got it coming. But don't take that next drink. Just don't take it. And eventually the shakes will go away also. And you might say, but how about this spot in my throat? And I might say, yeah, it hurts, don't it? Seems like the only thing that'll make it quit hurting is another drink. I used to have a doozy. It started in the right side of my nose and went into this ear and ended up here. Worse than cancer it was. The only thing that would stop it was another drink. But if we don't take that next drink, it'll go away and we don't have to take another drink to stop it. And you might say, well, how about sleeping? I can't sleep. And I might say, stay awake. Stay awake. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 nights and days. Sweating, freezing, shaking, dying, and walking. And you can go to sleep. If you don't take that next drink. Just don't take it. And you might say, well, how about tapering off? And I might say, I have nothing against it. If you can do it. Go ahead. I could never do it myself. I've tapered on about 1,000 times. But I could never taper off. I tried tapering off on the stuff I was drinking, and I got just as drunk as I did when I drank seriously. I tried tapering off on beer. Beer is just as bad as the other. It's not much different. A little slower and a little wetter. I tried to taper off on wine and brethren and sister, and there's something that wine. I could walk around for 2 weeks about 3 feet off the sidewalk and not hit a thing like a zombie. It's the only thing I've ever known that'll hang you without a rope or a judge. And you'd end up just as drunk and a great deal sicker. So the only way I know of to sober up is don't take that next drink. Just leave it alone. This is our first problem. This is our first problem. We must get far enough away from the bottle that we might hear and do the things that our program suggests. So this is our first problem. Now, whilst we're attempting to sober up, it is real good to keep something in the stomach other than alcohol. Sugar and water is good. Karo syrup and water is very good. Drink it. Keep it. Drink a lot of it. I used to have a little concoction that I made out of milk and a raw egg and a little nutmeg and a little sugar and just a pinch of lemon extract. Just a pinch. Now that's real good if you can keep it down. But if you can't keep it down, don't get discouraged. Try it again. You know, we weren't too easily discouraged when we couldn't keep that first slug down in the morning. That didn't bother us too much. We kept at it. I used to have an old drinking buddy that kept 2 brands of liquor. He had 1 very cheap brand for throwing up purposes. And the first time he'd get one to stick, he'd quick switch bottles. He'd say to me, you're not going to catch me throwing up the good stuff. So it is a real good thing to keep liquid in your stomach while you're sobering up. And any place from 3 to 7 days, depending on the duration of the drunk, we can get physically sober. It isn't too difficult to get physically sober if we don't take a drink. But if you would say to me, how do I remain sober? How do I stay sober? I would say, well, this is a horse of a different color. This is an entirely different problem, because if you be alcoholic, and if you want to live without drinking, this is a lifetime proposition. Whilst you can get sober in 3 to 7 days, if you be alcoholic and want to remain sober, it's a lifetime job. We start now and keep going from now on. And I'm one who believes that there are only two classes of alcoholics who can fulfill the conditions for sobriety. The first class are those like myself who run out of everything at once. When you run out of people and time and money and health and sanity and liquor all at once, this is a pretty good way place to start. It's not so difficult to fulfill the conditions for sobriety when there is nothing else to do. So in crisis, we can fulfill the conditions. And the other class are those who come to see the nature of our problem. I think it's absolutely necessary for those who haven't run out of time to come to see the nature of our problem, lest we will not do the things necessary to get sober and stay sober. Now, I recognize that I had a problem with liquor 10 years before I came to this program. But I thought it was a personal weakness. A weakness of my very own, something that I had to overcome in order to live without this problem. And I worked on that problem for the next 10 years, diligently. And the harder I worked, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I worked. And I never did know the nature of my problem until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Completely destitute. And I went to many places where they should have been able to tell me the nature of my problem, but they didn't know. I went to priests, to preachers, to doctors, to psychiatrists, and they didn't know the nature of my problem. In those days, few did. They talked to me about willpower and backbone and standing up and being a man. And they couldn't help me, because I didn't think there was anything wrong with my willpower. There might have been a little something wrong with my won't power, but my willpower worked very good. I could get liquor in Kansas on election day. And it didn't take long if the need were great. If you were bouncing real high, you could do it in a hurry. I didn't think there was anything wrong with my backbone. I had made my own way since I was 13 years old, and I've been quite an athlete in my life, and I thought my backbone was in pretty good shape. And my standing up and being a man department was the department in which I excelled. I had been a system man. I knew there was something that I had to have from the beginning, and I thought I could get it out of one of the systems or somebody in one of the systems. So I made it my business for 30 years to go through the system. I would take this one, and when I had gone as far as I could go and nothing had happened, I discarded it and I took another. And I became quite a man, for a system man. I explained Catholicism to the Catholics, Judaism to the Jews, and Mohammedanism to the Mohammedans. Again, until I fell off the bar stool. But I eventually couldn't get out of bed to go tell them how much I knew. And that's bad for a philosopher, in my ability, I'll tell you that. But I thought very well of my standing up and being a man department, and so I didn't get any help from any of them. And it wasn't until I came here that I learned the nature of my problem. Why can't I drink liquor successfully? I can do nearly anything I want to. Why can't I drink liquor successfully? Because I am an alcoholic. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a person who suffers with the disease of alcoholism. The disease of alcoholism. Why didn't somebody tell me this? I never heard alcoholism mentioned as a disease until I came to AA. And I remain to hear it described as the third worst killer in the United States, second only to heart and cancer. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. Second only to one of our social diseases as a cause for permanent insanity. And that's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. And medically speaking, an incurable disease. And that's the nature of my problem. That's what I got. I'm an alcoholic. Probably the best definition that you and I will ever hear of the disease of alcoholism was given to us by a doctor, the late Dr. Silkworth of Town Hospital in New York. It is said that Dr. Silkworth attended not less than 40 and probably over 50,000 alcoholics during his practicing lifetime, so he should have known what he was talking about. And he says that this is a disease of a twofold nature. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that my body cannot successfully handle alcohol. I am different than 90% of those who drink liquor. They tell us that there's something over 70 million people in the United States that drink liquor. And there are only 5 to 6 million of us who are classified as alcoholics. My body cannot oxidize, burn up, and get rid of alcohol. When I take one slug of liquor, I retain it. It goes into the bloodstream and to the brain. And it triggers something in my body that demands that I keep on drinking. That I keep on drinking until the cycle is run. Now again, this is not true with 90% of those who drink liquor. It's only true of the alcoholic. Now this is a very interesting thing, the physical side of the disease of alcoholism. Very interesting to me. Because there isn't a doctor in the world that can tell me why I cannot successfully handle alcohol. There is not one in the whole world that can tell me what works too fast or too slow or doesn't work in my body. About half the experts think that we were born with the physical inability to react normally to alcohol. I'm talking about medical experts. That we are doomed, were doomed to become alcoholic from birth if we drank liquor. And there's much evidence to support this. There are many in this room tonight who went overboard with the very first drink they ever took. Drank compulsively from the very first drink they ever took. And the other half of the experts think it's the damaging effect of the alcohol on the system that eventually causes us to lose our ability to react normally to alcohol. And there's much evidence along this line, too, because I drank for 15 years before getting into serious trouble. But every expert says this, and this is the thing I must remember forever. That I must keep uppermost in my consciousness at all times. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. There isn't one case in medical science where any alcoholic has ever been able to return to successful drinking. This is the thing I must remember. There is not one case amongst us, and we're some 350,000 strong, where any one of us has ever been able to return to successful drinking. And this we must remember. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Now there's another thing about the physical part of the disease that to me is most interesting. And that is that it gets worse even when we ain't doing it. You know, this is different from anything else I ever heard of. Even tuberculosis, when it is in an arrested state, the body builds against it. But not so with alcoholism. Actually, we get less able to react normally to alcohol with the passage of time, even when we are totally dry. Strange as it might seem, I am 14 years worse off, so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned, than I was when I came crawling into my first meeting 14 years ago in January. This I must always remember also, and this is one of the greatest reasons in the world for us staying active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably the most heartbreaking thing we are ever called upon to do is to sit in the dark room with a gal or a guy who has been sober all the way from five to 15 years and hold their hand and smell that secondhand formaldehyde and that 30-day-old booze oozing out of the pores and hear them cry, why? Because they forgot. This is a heartbreak. But this will keep us totally and completely conscious of the fact that the physical part of this disease gets worse, never better, with the passage of time. And lastly, medically speaking, it's incurable. Now this is the nature of my problem. What am I going to do about it? I cannot drink. Successful. I have no good drinking time left, period. And there's nothing I can do about the physical side of the disease. So what am I going to do? Turn to the other half of the disease. The mental obsessions that cause us to take the first drink. There is no physical demand for liquor when we are dry. When the body has no liquor in it, it does not demand liquor. It's only after the first drink that the physical takes over. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink are physical, but the first one is mental. And if we be alcoholic, and if we wish to live without drinking, we must be rid of the mental obsessions that cause us to drink. And this takes a little doing. This is the reason we must come to see the nature of our problem. Because we will not do the things we have to do unless we come to see that the only three things that can happen to an alcoholic are to die an alcoholic death, which to me 15 years ago was far preferable to life. Or to be put in a laughing academy someplace and spend the rest of our lives in the insane department. Or to find a way of living that does not include alcohol. The obsessions of the mind are the reason that willpower will not do anything for us. Because the obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. It's just as silly for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. If the tubercular is going to get rid of the cough, he must be rid of the tuberculosis. If I, being an alcoholic, want to be rid of the bottle, I must be rid of the obsessions of the mind that cause me to drink. I am condemned by the obsessions of the mind to drink whiskey, and I am condemned by the allergy of the body to die if I do. This is the nature of the problem. And so it takes a little doing if we're going to get rid of these obsessions of the mind. And I am one who gets a great kick out of this thing because I think that our founding fathers dealt with us very lightly indeed when they put the words in here, obsessions of the mind. This is just a sneaky way of telling us that we are insane. Now, you know, we don't like that word, insane. We don't like this at all. We alcoholics would quickly admit that we did a lot of insane things when we were drunk. But we persist in the illusion that we're pretty smooth operators when we're sober. But the book isn't talking about the insane things that we did when we were drunk. It's talking about the insanity between drunks that will allow us to look right straight at a 25-year record and come up with the profound conclusion, this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. I've analyzed that last drunk. I see exactly where I made my mistakes. Now, I'm not going to do that anymore. This is insanity. Now, what do I mean by a 25-year record? A lot of things happen to you if you happen to be an alcoholic, and if you've been at it for 25 years. And they go something like this, quickly, and every one of us know them, so I'll run through them fast. First you get drunk, and then you get drunker and stay drunk longer. Then you start having a little trouble really close about home, and then your trouble spreads a bit. The gendarmes get you and keep you without your permission, stuff like that. Then you start having a little trouble with time. You start losing it, first an hour or two, and then a day or two, and then a week or two, and finally you don't know what month you're living in. They call that a blackout. Then you start having a little trouble with animals. Normal animals that people know about and animals that people never heard about at all. Now I've gotten a terrific boot the last couple of years. There's some psychiatrist someplace that's trying to tell us that you can't dream in color. I sure would have liked to have that monkey with me on a few occasions. I could have showed him Technicolor on a big screen. Then you start having a little trouble with music. The banjos are playing, and there's no banjo player anyplace. This is probably the nicest thing that happens to us. You know, a lot of that music is awful good music. But there's no knobs around. You can't turn it off. Then you start having a little trouble with people. You start meeting them, talking to them, and they talk to you, and they're not there. To this day, I think this is the thing that gave my family the greatest discomfort and was the most difficult for them to understand. Because on many occasions, we'd all be in the same living room together, and I would have company, and they wouldn't have any. Very confusing. And then you start falling on the floor in your face and chewing your tongue full of holes and babbling like an idiot in an alcoholic fit, or if you're sensitive, in an alcoholic convulsion. And finally you spread eagle and you don't chew your tongue and you don't babble, you turn blue. And if you're lucky as I was, the oxygen squad gets there in time to wake you up. Now, this is the course that we all go through. And to be able to look at this record and come up with the conclusion, this time it's going to be different. This is insanity, and it shouldn't be too difficult for us to see it. As a matter of fact, it isn't too tough to be insane if you know it. It's only when you're nuts and you don't know it that it's bad, you know. But let's just make a little test. Somebody made this pretty thing here after he got sobered up, and it's quite a lethal instrument. It's pretty tough. If I stood here for 5 minutes and beat myself over the head with this thing, you'd all get up and go home. You wouldn't even wait for the sandwiches and the coffee. You'd say there's no sense to listen to this boy. He's nuts. The second step hasn't started to do anything for him yet. And yet that only hurts right there, just in that one spot, and it sort of feels good when I quit it. It has nothing to recommend it to the hurt when you're trying to sober up after, say, a lousy 30-day drunk. Now, there's something that hurts. Everything about you hurts. Your head hurts, your eyes hurt, your throat hurts, your lungs hurt, your heart hurts. Every once in a while, an arm goes off into space and you don't know what it's doing out there. You'd be lying flat on your back in bed, and boom, they hit you, and you're 10 feet off from the floor. Alcoholic cramps. Your hair hurts. And everything in the room with you hurts. Now, you'd say if a guy went through that, say, 5 times, or give him 6, you'd say, well, he don't learn easy, does he? But you know how long I went through that stuff? 10 years! 10 years! And I can still come up with the profound conclusion, this time it's going to be different. And sure enough, it was. It was worse, just like it's always been. This is insanity. And if we want to live without drinking, we must be rid of this insanity. And that's the reason we love this book so much. And if you haven't got it, get it. And if you get it, read it. And if you get it and read it, do it. Do it. If you want to be sober. Because this book tells us about us and about our problem and about the answer. And it tells us that the reason we couldn't do it ourselves is because we lack the power. We lack the power. We lack the power. It says we're like people who've lost their legs. We never go new. It says that a good philosophy won't do it for us. Self-knowledge won't do it for us, says the book. It says that every one of us stopped, looked at ourselves, saw what a lousy job we were doing at the business of living, decided to do better, says the book, but we lacked the power. And if we lacked the power, it was obvious that we had to find one. And it was just as obvious that it be a power greater than ourselves. This I believe as I believe that I'm here, and for just as simple a reason. If I could have stayed sober, I would not believe it. But I could not stay sober, therefore I believe it. I lack the power. Where was this power when I was waking up in jail? Where was this power when I was writhing in the floor, chewing my tongue full of holes? It certainly was not operating in me. I lacked the power. And I think that the finest formula under heaven for finding the power or bringing the power into operation in our lives is the 12 steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And I don't believe that any individual, regardless of how far he or she has gone in the disease of alcoholism, can fulfill the conditions of the 12 steps to the best of his or her ability and fail to receive the power. I don't think it's possible. I do not think that this is a special dispensation or a special grant or a special favor. Something that's given to some and withheld from others, I do not believe it. I believe that it's just a matter of fulfilling the conditions and the power is there, just as inevitable as sunrise. Why do I believe this? Because I have seen those from all walks of life. I've seen the priest and the preacher right alongside the agnostic and the atheist. I've seen the doctor and the lawyer and the businessman and the housewife and the bootblack and the streetwalker. I've seen the black man, the white man, the Jew, the Gentile, and the Greek come to this program in the same condition that I came. And I've seen them do the same things that I have done in their own way. And I've seen each one of them come back to normal and through normal to the happy and peaceful and joyous way of life that is known as the AA way of life. Now, if this were a special grant or a special dispensation, some of us would have missed the boat. Either the Catholic would have gotten it and I couldn't, or the Jew would have gotten it and I couldn't, the black man would have gotten it and I couldn't. Certainly the atheist couldn't have had it. But strange as it might seem, oft times the atheist gets it quicker than the priest or the preacher. So my business is to fulfill the conditions. Now if we can get simple enough, if we can just get simple enough to see this, we're almost home free. I think that mainly where we have our trouble is that we get lost in the wrong half of the miracle. We hear some monkey like me get up and say we have to have some help from a power greater than ourselves. And we immediately start trying to get that. We read the third step and it says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. And we say to ourselves, I don't understand him. I must get me a tutor. I must get me another book. And we get another book and we read and nip and read. And pretty soon we're worse off than we were in the beginning. We are not miracle men here. The miracle is not our business. If we had been miracle men, we would have said to the monkey, get off my shoulder, and he would have got. But I said to the monkey, get off of my shoulder, and you know what he did? He sat right there and had a litter of pups. We are not miracle men. And we do not bring this miracle about. It says right here, here are the steps we took. We're sober. Here are the steps we took. And the first third of step number 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Now this certainly implies that someplace between step 1 and step 12, something has happened. The power has been added. Now this is my business, that I do these things and let the miracle happen. The miracle will happen, all right, if I do these things. When I hear somebody say, well, I see I have to find God before I can get sober. My stomach falls clear through my shoes. I tried for 35 years to find God, and I never found Him. And I came here not looking for Him, but looking for sobriety. And I did these things to the best of my ability one day at a time, and woke up to the fact that I'd moved out of hell into heaven, and I had to thank God. The miracle happened. This is our business, that we fulfill these conditions. Now that is probably our greatest difficulty, that we get lost in the wrong half of the miracle. Now the second thing is that we don't recognize it when it's happened. We think it's something else. I think many of us have been conditioned to believe that spiritual things were a little out of this world. Some mystical something that might light on us and might miss us, or something. And we keep waiting and listening for the bells to ring and the lights to flash in a great spiritual experience. I often thank God that the lights quit flashing and the bells quit ringing when I came here. I'd had about all that I could handle. You know, I got a car a few years back, and it had a bell on that direction thing. And it's the only one I've ever seen that had a little bell on it. And the first time I pushed that thing up, fortunately Mrs. C. was with me. And pretty soon she says, oh, listen to the pretty little bell. And I said, did you hear too? I thought they had me again. The thing happens and we keep looking for something else. A few years back, a guy down on South Broadway came up to me after a meeting, and he says, Chuck, he says, when in the hell am I going to have this spiritual awakening? He says, people keep saying, keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back, and it'll happen. But he says, it don't. Well, I says, how long you been coming back? And he says, 8 years. Well, he was a man as old as I, and real nicely dressed and good-looking guy. And I said to him, well, have you had any trouble? Why, no, he says, I haven't had a drink since my first night. And seeing how well he looked, I said, what else has happened to you? And he started listing the good things that had happened to him. And so help me, everything good had happened to him, except he hadn't been elected president of the United States yet. And by the time he got through, I was laughing like a fool, and he got mad at me because he was very serious about this thing. And I said, man, wake up. You've had it for 8 years. You don't know it. Could you get sober before you came here? And he says, no. If I could have, I wouldn't have come. But you came here and something happened. And you haven't had to have a drink since, yes. Did these good things happen in your life before you came here? And he said, no. But you came here and something happened, and good things have happened in your life, yes. You couldn't do it, no. Well, why don't you start thanking God now, and maybe you've got the whole package. Maybe this is the only thing you lack. The thing's happened, you've had it for 8 years. And then I got to thinking. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I cannot live and drink. Now this I know. This I know. There's no question in the world about it. It's one of the few things that I know in life. I cannot live and drink. And of myself, I cannot keep from drinking. So what could God give me that would be half so acceptable as the ability to live without drinking? Do you ever think of that? Nothing. There isn't anything under heaven that could be quite so dear to me as the ability to live without drinking. This is tops. Because it's life to me. Now let's put a couple of little simple things with that. Good living. What about eating? What about eating? Maybe there's a lot of people in this room that never missed a meal. Maybe you think that eating is a physical thing. You get hungry and you eat. But not so with me. I've been eating now for 14 years, and I can't sit down and eat without having perhaps something similar to the experience that the devout get when they take the Blessed Sacrament. Why, this eating thing is fabulous. You know that I've spent 2 weeks trying to get to the chili joint at the exact second when I could swallow? It has to be a dead heat, too, you know. If you get there half a block too soon, no chili. A half a block too late, no chili. I went to San Fernando one time a while back to yak a little, and the guy got up to lead the meeting, and he says, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in a $14 suit with $35 worth of chili. Down the front of it! And I almost jumped up and kissed him. The ability to taste, smell, eat, and enjoy food. Why, this is the greatest thing in the world. This is good living. This is well-being. Now, how about sleep? Many of you might think that sleeping is physical. Maybe you never lost a night's sleep. But to me, it's fabulous, this sleep. Talk about a spiritual experience. I can flop down on this floor and go to sleep right now. And yet I've lain in that bed day after day, night after night, day after day, and no sleep. Because the time comes, if you keep messing with that flit, when you can drink it by the tumbler, and you can't get sober, and you can't get drunk, and you can't live, and you can't die. And you're worn out, and you have to sleep, and you're coming all unglued to joints, and you're dying. And you're finally in complete and utter anguish. You yell out, God, please, please, let me sleep for 20 minutes. Let me rest for 20 minutes, and there's no rest. Sleeping is a wonderful thing. It's good living. It's well-being. Now let's add just one more thing. Let's add people. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was fresh out of people. I had nobody but me, and I hated me. And now I've got people. People to whom I belong and people who belong to me. A kinship, first with a bunch of drunks who don't have to drink anymore. And finally, it spreads to include the human race. And finally, it spreads to include God, the Father of life. These are the things that happen to us in AA when we fulfill the conditions. And it can't keep from happening if we do the things that this book suggests. What are they? Well, the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I like them all. I'd love to talk about all of them, because both are very personal and very dear to me. I have 24 steps in my program, because I include 12 traditions. But we can't talk about them all, and I only talk about three things. First, surrender. Second, the recognition of the need for help. And third, enough self-honesty to see ourselves as we are, and enough honesty to do something about it. And yet if I talk with about all 24 of them, there's only one difficult thing in the program. There is just one thing in all of our program that's difficult, and that's the very first step, the surrender. But that's almost impossible for an alcoholic. This is the reason we must see the nature of our problem. Because, you see, an alcoholic was not made to surrender. An alcoholic was built to win, and we almost did. We almost took from life what we wanted on our own terms. But we got just a little bit alcoholic, and that's all, brother. We couldn't surrender because we have always thought that surrender was for the weak. The weak man surrenders. The strong man wins the battle. So we keep fighting the battle 10 years after we've lost it. Now, I'd rather be able to explain what it means to surrender than to do anything else that this life affords. I would be perfectly willing to die on the way home if I could tell one audience what it means to surrender. But it cannot be done. It cannot be done. The only way to find out is to do it. But this much we can say about it. From the moment I threw in the towel until now, I haven't had to take another drink. And that was perhaps 2 weeks before I ever made my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. In the middle of a drunk, it happened to me. It's perhaps the only thing that allows you and I to live in freedom. There is no freedom without it. Until we get rid of the necessity for ego satisfaction. Get rid of this Simon Legree that has driven us like a slave driver for a lifetime. There is no peace. There is no freedom. Don't be afraid of this surrender. Truly, this is a battle we win in surrender. Great Catholic authority back in the 12th or 13th century in speaking of this thing, talked in this wise. He said, "You have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum and can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small." Now he says, all you got to do is move out, get empty of self in surrender, and automatically you get full of God. I don't know anything about this, but I do know that from the moment of surrender, enough power was added that I have never had to take another drink. Don't be afraid of it. To abandon ourselves completely to this simple program, this is victory. Secondly, the recognition of the need for help, and that's all we need in the first place. If there be those who think they're atheists or agnostics, don't let it bother you for a second. Because all you need do is to recognize that you can't win alone, that you need help from any place. It doesn't make any difference where it comes from. Just to recognize that we have failed and that we need help from someplace is enough to start. the rest will come. And lastly, enough self-honesty to see ourselves as we are, and enough honesty to do something about it. Now, all in the world that means is that the last excuse must go over the board. If we be alcoholic, and if we have one excuse left that is still acceptable to ourselves, we have another drunk left. Who on earth is going to surrender when it's the mother-in-law's fault? Ha! As long as we can pin this on another living soul, we're not going to surrender. I know, because I only had one excuse the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking, and they were the drunkenest years I ever lived. And that one excuse was my mother-in-law. We had a mutual hate in society that to this day stands nonpareil. And so that was my final excuse. The mother-in-law reminds me of a little story, and I'll tell this and then hurry along and sit down. I was down in Texas, and one of my good friends down there was telling about the two drunks that met on the street. One of them says to the other, "How's things?" He says, "Not good." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, he got married." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, he got my mother-in-law, too." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, she's got money." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, she wants to boss everything." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, she bought us a house." Well, he says, "That's good." He says, "Not so good, the house burned down." Well, he says, "That's bad." He says, "Not so bad, brother." He says, "She burned too." And so that last excuse has got to burn up. It's got to go by the boards. We must come to see that if there be fault, it is mine. I'm the monkey that can't live without that bottle. If there be fault, it is mine. And then, honest enough to do something about it, namely, to practice these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. These are the conditions for sobriety. Now, if you want to be sober, do these things. Do these things, because the only way that you will ever know that the program will work is to do it and see. You see, you can't take my word for it. Maybe I'm not even an alcoholic. Did anyone here ever see me drunk? To your knowledge? I doubt it. Maybe I'm not even an alcoholic. Maybe I just joined this leper colony for the social prestige. Or you might say, well, maybe you are alcoholic, because you wouldn't have known so much about it if you weren't. And I will concede that the program has worked for you, but it won't work for me. I'm different. Wonder how different you are. Do you reckon you shook a little different than I did? Did you have a little shake all your own? Did you smell any different than I did? Do you reckon? Could anybody in the next room have told whether it was you or I spread-eagled on the bathroom floor with our arms around the throne, working out a set of dry heaves? I'll bet you they wouldn't have known whether it was you or I. Now you might say, you mustn't talk about these things. This is a public meeting, and those things aren't nice. Don't say those things. If there is anything at all that is nice about the life of a practicing alcoholic, I got gypped. The only good thing about alcoholism is the answer. And the answer to the problem is worth every second of hell that it took to bring us here. How long it takes, and what it takes, but it is worth it. I have come to believe that we're the most fortunate amongst men. I do not believe that there is a segment of the human race that is quite so fortunate as we. Why? Because we have an incurable disease, and because the disease is progressive, and because the time comes when we cannot live without an answer. And we come here, what for? To find God? No. To get the family back? No. To get health? No. For peace and serenity? Never heard of them. We came here to get sober. I had every problem, I guess, that you can get. My good wife, after 25 years, was going through the divorce court. Our children wouldn't come home when I was around, if they could keep from it. My boss had let it be known that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window don't open. I had no health, no sanity, no family, no job, no money, no nothing. But I came here for one thing, that I might find a way to live without liquor. And they said to me, here are the steps we took. And I could look at them, and I knew they were drunks because they were marked like me. But I saw their eyes. And I knew they had something that I would rather have than life itself. And so I decided my very first night I wanted what you had. And I became willing to go to any length to get it. But I left that meeting with a great fear upon me. I didn't think I had enough left to get it. And for 6 long months I was in a meeting every night with this fear upon me. And after 6 months, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been from the first. The power had been at me. And that's over 13.5 years ago. And everything that's happened in my life for 14 years has happened, and I have to look back to see why. And inasmuch as it's a little bit late, I'm not going through the way that it happened to me, but I'm just going to tell you a few things that have happened and a few of the things that have become so dear to me in the last year and a half of my life. Now, I have the same wife that I've always. And we've had 13.5 of the most marvelous years that you can imagine. We have the same children. But what a difference. They think your dad's all right. On my third birthday, my big guy who's 6'3½ brought me a little present, and he wrote on the card, "All I ever hope to do or to be is to be like." I bawled for 2 hours. He it was who wouldn't come home. I had the same boss for 12 years. And he's retired now and I own the business. I feel a little bit guilty, a little bit sinful to say that, because it's a big business. But that's the way it happened to me. I've had me 14 years. Real differently, because I sort of get along all right with me now. Sort of peaceful in inside. And I've had you, a family that extends throughout the world. It's terrific. And I've had God, a God of my very own. All of this through the miracle of alcoholism. And since we moved down to Laguna, when I have a free evening, I sit there and look out the window. We're up on a hill above the town. And out of our window, you can see just about everything that God ever made. There's the mountains and the valley and the ocean and the island and the heaven. And I sit there looking out at this window with the lights out and thinking and looking at the miracle of alcoholism. And pretty soon faces start crossing that window. And I sit there and cry. And look at these faces as they go by. And many of those faces are in this room tonight. And I get to thinking about this great miracle of AA. And I get to thinking about the struggle that I've made for 35 years to find God. And I get to thinking about coming to a bunch of people whom I didn't like at all, a bunch of drunkies, who shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And I get to thinking that my interest might have been misplaced for 35 years. And I get to thinking about a little story in the good book. I think it's about the judgment day. You remember there was a judge there and there were people trying to get into heaven, I reckon. And the judge would tell them, I never heard of you and this and that. And finally a little old nondescript guy walks up. The judge says, go on in. He says, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was sick and you visited. And the little guy says, no, says, you must have me mixed up with somebody else. He says, I never saw you before. And the guy says, go on in. He says, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, you did it also unto me. And I say, well, that's AA. That's AA. Maybe it's in sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love that we come to know love. And the book says, God is love. And then I remember another little story. I think it was in the last few days that the carpenter was here. He called his friend Peter into him, and he says, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, yea, Lord. And he says, tend my sheep. And he asked him the second time, and he said, yea, Lord. He says, tend my sheep. And the third time he asked him, and he said, tend my sheep. And I think maybe it's in tending the sheep that we come to know the shepherd. This is the great lesson of AA. You see how fortunate we are. In that we come not even looking for the answer to the riddle of life. And we remain to find that the conditions for sobriety and the conditions of the good life and the conditions of God are one and the same. And we find a living answer to a living problem, because indeed alcoholism is a living problem. And the answer is so simple, so very simple. It's nothing in the world but a personally and individually acceptable partnership with God as I understand Him, with God as you understand Him in the business of life.